You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap. Welcome to the reading of the Council Buffs Daily Nonpareil for September 8th, 2021. I'm Brian Orellana from Drake University, and here is our first story. Our first story of the day is Nebraska's growing more diverse numbers in state's small towns dwelling. Written by Matt Olberding from the Lincoln Journal Star. The 2020 census produced some pretty predictable numbers for Nebraska, and some that maybe weren't expected. For example, all of the population growth and then some occurred in the state's three largest counties, Douglas, Lancaster, and Sarpy. That's a result that was expected because it follows a pattern in past census numbers. Since 1980, those counties combined have added a little more than 420,000 people, while other 90 counties have lost about 30,000 people. The three counties now account for 56% of the state's population, up 43% from 1980. There's an image that says, more young people. Nebraska has 7.8% more children under 18, but growth among children is focused on 12 counties. And the states that, and one of those counties that increase is Lincoln. The lack of population gains in rural areas has kept Nebraska's overall per decade growth in the single digit percentage range over the past several decades. But last year's 7.4% growth did reach one unexpected milestone. It matched overall U.S. growth for the first time in more than a century. That was partially due to a decline in overall growth in the U.S., but is also due to the fact that the 2010s were the second best decade in the past century in terms of population growth in Nebraska. The 30,000-foot view is that Nebraska had a solid population growth thanks to more people moving to areas in and around its two largest cities. But when you take a closer look, you see that there are a number of more specific trends feeding the larger result. Here's a look at some of those trends courtesy of research from the Center for Public Affairs at the University of Nebraska and at Omaha. Voluntary response key. The Census Bureau uses two main ways to get its information: voluntary responses, either online or on paper, and in-person interviews. Areas with high voluntary response rates, meaning households filled out their census documents. The Census Bureau uses two main ways to get its information: voluntary responses, either online or on paper, and in-person interviews. Areas with high voluntary response rates, meaning households filled out their census documents and didn't have to be tracked down, tended to have higher population growth. For example, of the 15 counties in Nebraska with the highest self-response rate, 13 of them wound up with higher population counts in the official census than what had been estimated. That included Lancaster County, which had the third highest self-response rate at 78.1%, and wound up with an official population that was 0.8% higher than estimated. Sarpy County, which had the highest self-response rate, also had the highest population growth of any county, 20%. Its actual population wound up 1.2% higher than estimated. The correlation held for counties where self-response lag. Of the 15 counties with the lowest self-response rate, 13 had populations lower than estimated, including Thomas County, which was dead last in self-response rate with 42.3%, and which also had the largest gap, 9%, between estimated population and actual population. Natural growth versus migration. Nebraska continued a trend that started in the 1990s of actually having more people moving into the state than out. In the 2010s, there was a net immigration of just more than 37,000 people, a huge increase over the 2000s, but not quite as good as the 1990s, which saw a net gain of 48,237 people moving in. That helped make up for declining natural population growth from birth exceeding death. The state added just more than 98,000 people via natural growth over the past decade, a 5.4% increase. That growth ranked among the lowest in terms of natural population gain in state history. Larger towns and cities. While only 24 of 93 counties added population in the 2010s, overall, 183 of Nebraska's 529 incorporated cities, towns, and villages, or 35%, gained people. Also, the number of communities that lost more than 10% of their population dropped from 205 in the 2000s to 161 in the 2010s. Where did that growth occur? By and large, it was the larger cities, though the five fastest growing communities all had populations between 1,000 and 5,000, and 13 of the 15 fastest growing places had fewer than 5,000 people. Growth largely occurred in cities with more than 10,000 people. Among cities with more than 50,000 people, of which there are only four, Bellevue, Grand Island, Lincoln, and Omaha, the combined growth rate was 17.3%. Overall, cities and towns with at least 1,000 people saw growth on average, while small towns with less than 1,000 people collectively lost population. College student trend. Nebraska had fewer students living in its college dorm rooms in 2020 than it did in 2010. Overall, the census counted 20,831 students living in dorms last year, down 5.6% from 22,073. The pandemic likely played a role in reducing those numbers because some students may have taken a year or dropped out because of COVID-19 conditions. The trend was not even across the state, however. Some counties with small colleges saw strong increases in students living in dorms. That included Madison County, Dodge County, Nemaha County, Sarpy County, and York County. Lancaster County also had a small increase of 3.6%. But that was much smaller than the 21% gain it saw from 2000 through 2010. On the other end of the spectrum, Saline County, home to Doane University, saw its dorm population drop 72.5%. Other counties with large losses included Lincoln, Adams, and Dawes County. Douglas County saw its dorm population fall more than 5%, while Buffalo County had Some of the statewide drop is attributed to the closing of Dana College in Belair. Washington County had a college dorm population of 357 in the 2010 census, which dropped to zero in 2020. David Drazid, research coordinator at UNO's Center for Public Affairs Research, said the dorm numbers are... David Drazin, research coordinator at UNO's Center for Public Affairs Research, said the dorm numbers weren't as bad as some officials feared. They could have been because of COVID-19. Drazin said administrators at several institutions submitted their official dorm counts to the Census Bureau to aid the on-campus count. Nebraska becoming more diverse. The minority population has been growing in Nebraska for decades, driven more recently by Hispanic immigration. The state added about 150,000 people of color over the last decade, about 60,000 through net immigration, and about 90,000 through natural change. The minority population in Nebraska now exceeds 475,000 and has quadrupled since 1990. The number of white residents declined by more than 15,000, reversing the trend of the past couple of decades that has seen small growth in that population. More than 52,600 whites moved out of the state, while only about 37,500 white babies were born during the decade. That means that without the minority growth, Nebraska would have lost population. Of the 24 counties that grew in the 2010s, 16 of them got all of their growth from increase in minority populations, meaning their white population declined. That includes Hall, Poteet, Madison, and Dodge counties. In the eight smaller counties, an increase in the minority population accounted for more than half of the growth, ranging from 87% in Cass County to 52.5% in Southers County. Non-whites made up 86% of Douglas County's growth, and 70% of gains in Lancaster County. It is not clear whether the white population actually declined by that much or whether a slight change in wording on the census form encouraged people to report themselves as both white and some other race. The number of people in Nebraska who reported themselves as a non-Hispanic and two or more other races grew by more than 150%. Because of that, Drow said that the narrative of declining white population isn't that simple. Now we're about to read our next story. Our next story is titled, New Visions Homeless Services Receives Grant from United Ways. New Visions Homeless Services was awarded a $95,000 grant from United Way of the Midlands to help them continue to serve the Council Bluffs Omaha area. To be funded by them is definitely a privilege because they have such a high funding expectation, unquote, said Brandy Waller, Chief Operating Officer at New Visions Homeless Services. New Visions will put the funding towards the Joshua House and to help provide more services to veterans who are experiencing homelessness. Waller said, this will help New Visions provide emergency food and shelter to nearly 500 people in Council Bluffs this year. United Way has awarded New Visions grants before, but this year's amount was higher than previous years. Quote, it's great to have a higher rate of funding because our services have increased along with the need for housing and food security, unquote, Waller said. Services featured at New Visions include food programming, 24-hour emergency shelter, permanent housing programs, and veteran programs. Quote, with the help of this grant, New Visions will be able to offer emergency food and shelter to nearly 500 individuals in Council Bluffs this year. Unquote, a press release from New Visions said, quote, in addition, our Omaha Veterans Campus will be able to serve nearly 150 veterans who are experiencing homelessness. The organization's food program, MOHMS Place Meal Site in Council Bluffs, provides meals to those experiencing food insecurity. Previously, New Visions did mobile food giveaways, where they would go into the neighborhoods that didn't have access to bus routes or didn't live near a grocery store and would hand out food. Permanent housing programs include the Joshua House, a 24-hour emergency shelter for homeless men in and around the area, and the Timothy House, which provides stable housing, especially for those who are currently homeless. The veteran program includes David's House, which is a permanent housing program for veterans who are chronically homeless. There is also the Veterans Transitional Living Program to assist veterans in regaining their independence while also helping them recover from trauma they have experienced. New Visions also has a thrift warehouse at 321 Thick Street in Council Bluffs that provides discounted items and is a primary source of job training and employment for those who are looking for jobs while at New Visions. Quote, we wouldn't be able to do what we do without United Ways and all of those who support us, and we just want to say thank you, unquote, Walter said. Our next story is titled, Women's Funds of Southwest Iowa awards $57,250 to six nonprofits in largest grant cycle yet. Elizabeth Smart to keynote inaugural Impact for Women Summit in October. The Pottawatomie County Community Foundation has announced that the Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa, a foundation initiative, has awarded $57,250 in funding to six organizations during its last and largest grant cycle. The foundation said it has made grants to Applied Information Management Institutions, AIM, Family Inc., Mills County Public Health, Nuella Betterment Corporation, Project Pink, Inc., and Senior Futures, Inc., that will support programming projects that are focused on improving the quality of life and well-being of women and families in Southwest Iowa. Quote, over the last year, the Women's Fund has begun a wave of solutions-based impact because of the generosity of our community, unquote, Donna Dostal, President and CEO of Pottawatomie County Community Foundation, said in a release. Quote, we know that when we invest in the success and well-being of women in our communities, The benefits and outcomes have a positive effect throughout our region. During this funding cycle, we are pleased and excited to work with a dynamic group of nonprofit partners as they provide real solutions to create durable, positive movement toward helping women and families throughout Southwest Iowa. Unquote. Applied Information Management, AIM, was awarded $13,750 to help recruit and support women in their South. Applied Information Management, AIM, was awarded $13,750 to help recruit and support women in their Southwest Iowa Tech Training Initiative, a program designed to help participants learn the technical foundation needed to gain access to the metro area's fastest-growing H3, high-demand, high-skill, and high-wage technology careers. The Southwest Iowa Tech Training Initiative usually annually serves around 100 individuals residing in the following Iowa counties: Pottawatomie, Mills, Montgomery, and/or Harrison County. We are grateful to have the commitment and support for the Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa, said Candace Miller, President and CEO of AIM. This funding will allow us to expand the reach of our Southwest Iowa Tech Training Initiative to area schools and do a woman-focused recruiting campaign. Through the Southwest Iowa Tech Training Initiative, we will help address the need for more tech professionals in the Southwest Iowa region by connecting interested parties to a comparison training program that aims to connect, develop, and transition local talents to resources, mentors, and opportunities in technology. We will create a new tech workers that will help the Southwest Iowa area thrive. Family Inc. was awarded $10,000 to support their maternal health program, a program that provides nursing education and psychosocial support to pregnant women in Pottawatomie and Mills County who are on Medicaid through 6 weeks postpartum. The maternal health program's explicit goal is to make sure more babies can celebrate their first birthday, prevent infant mortality, and improve birth outcomes, and accomplished through family-centered community-based services. By supporting the maternal health program through Family Inc., the Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa made potentially life-saving resources available to women at one of the most beautiful and yet challenging moments in their lives, said Kimberly Kolowski, Executive Director of Family Inc. Quote, the personalized and home nursing and social work services provided through this funding will help women through their pregnancy and up to 6 weeks postpartum with the support they need to keep themselves and their child healthy. We know well that a healthy and whole parent dramatically increases their child's chances for success in the future. We are honored to partner with the Women's Funds of Southwest Iowa in making this happen. Unquote. Neola Betterment Corporation received $10,000 to support First Street Cottages, an affordable and safe senior-friendly housing development in Neola. Grant funding from PCCF will help subsidize the program costs of assisting senior citizens as they age in place with safe, senior-friendly housing and access to supportive services. Project Pinked was awarded $5,000 to support Healing Heart Survivor Kits developed for breast cancer survivors. By Project Pink Survivors, the Healing Hearts program provides kits to individuals who have been newly diagnosed with breast cancer with hopes of making treatment a little easier. A first within the region, each of the chemotherapy, radiation, and surgical kits contain everything needed to make survivors more comfortable, and the personal touch of a handwritten note from a Project Pink survivor is sure to brighten their day. From 2019 to 2020, Project Pink provided over 1,489 kits to hospitals throughout western Iowa and eastern Nebraska. Breast cancer survivors are faced with many unknowns throughout their treatment journey. While each mode of medical treatment is different and uncharted territory for the patient, Project Pink Inc. wants survivors who are going through the battle to know they are not alone. Mills County Public Health was awarded $13,500 for their WITS Workout Curriculum, a brain health program developed by the University of Illinois Extension, drawing on health and aging research. The WITS workout program focuses on brain exercises for all adults ages 50 and older. The interactive program provides increased socialization and promotes intellectual engagement, all of which complement current aging brain health research. Senior Futures Inc. received $5,000 to support the purchase of lawn and snow removal equipment to be used when providing services for low-income senior citizens in Harrison and Pottawatomie counties. The mission of Senior Futures Inc. is to provide a multitude of services to elderly and disadvantaged, including but not limited to health services, home maintenance, repairs and chore services, transportation and escort services, and telephone reassurance services. Also, the Pottawatomie County Community Foundation announced Elizabeth Smart will be featured speaker at the Impact for Women Summit on October 28th. As the Women's Fund of Southwest initiative continues to grow and build a tangible solution for issues facing women and their families throughout its communities, Pottawatomie County Community Foundation said it is hosting the inaugural Impact for Women Summit to continue the work. The event will be held at Amistar Casino Hotel Council Bluffs. According to the foundation, the hybrid event that will be a mix of in-person and virtual attendees, it will include special guest speakers Debbie Durham, Director of the Iowa Impact Development Authority and Iowa Finance Authority, and Don Oliver Winden, Executive Director of the Iowa Women's Foundation, who will address and observe the observable and real gap in funding of women initiatives in child care in Southwest Iowa. The event will conclude with speaker Elizabeth Smart, a survivor, New York Times bestselling author, and a national advocate for change related to child abduction, recovery programs, and national legislation. The abduction of Smart was one of the most followed child abductions cases in American history. Elizabeth Smart was abducted on June 5, 2002, and her captors controlled her by threatening to kill her and her family if she tried to escape. Fortunately, the police safely returned Elizabeth Smart back to her family on March 12, 2003, after being held a prisoner for 9 months. The founder of the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, she also helped promote the National Amber Alert, the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, and other safety legislation to help prevent abductions. The foundation said the Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa has tremendously sponsorship support from business leaders and individuals to make this year's summit a reality. Extended appreciation goes to Premier Platinum sponsor Brunel Contracting and Tamara Brunel for her generosity, enthusiasm, and strong commitment in support of the summit at the top sponsorship level. As a women business owner, I feel that I have the duty to support the Women's Fund of Southwest Iowa's Women's Summit as a way to give back to our local community, said Brunel, founder and president of Brunel Contracting. Quote, it is imperative that Southwest Iowa protects and identifies and supports women at all stages of life, education, and career. Keeping the women of Iowa empowered and healthy makes for stronger families and strong female role models for our future generations to look up to. A limited number of in-person tickets are available for purchase on Pottawatomie County Community Foundation website for $50 each. Additionally, as a COVID-19 precautionary measure for individuals and businesses unable to attend in person, PCCF will be offering $30 virtual tickets for guests to support the event from the comfort of their office or home, as well as join from across the state of Iowa. For additional information about tickets and sponsoring this year's summit, visit the foundation's website at rpccf.org or call 712-256-7007. You're listening to the Council Buffs Daily Nonpareil for September 8th, 2021 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Brian Orellana from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from the listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Now we're moving on to opinion. And the story we're reading today is Murphy, Plenty of Entourage in Special State House Election. On September 14, voters in parts of Ankeny and rural Polk County will elect a new representative to the Iowa House. Earlier this year, former Iowa Representative John Landon died from cancer, creating the vacancy. Landon, a Republican, had held the seat since 2013. But the district, like so many in the suburbs across Iowa and country, have been trending more Democratic. Landon managed to hold on to the seat in recent elections as other suburban Republicans fell, but the races were getting closer. So with one last election before the district and all others are changed by decennial redistricting, we will get one last look at how the political winds are blowing in this consistently growing district. Ankeny grew by 49% over the past decade, according to the U.S. Census data. These political winds have moved a bit in the district, and even more so in Ankeny. Other state house districts where Democrats unseated a Republican incumbent in 2018, but Republicans won it back in 2020. But there are other reasons to watch this election with political interest. Full disclosure, I live in this Ankeny district. It's a state house race in which local issues may be prominent as state level issues, specifically how schools operate during COVID-19 pandemic. Last school year, Ankeny became one of the state's focal points in the debate on how schools should operate during the pandemic. The district started the school year operating in a sort of hybrid system, with students alternating between days in the classroom and days working from home, and it also all required students and staff to wear face masks. The district's attempt to split the difference between reducing student population in order to preserve social distancing while still getting kids on site for in-person instruction was nonetheless met with strong resistance. A few Ankeny parents were ultimately at heart of the movement that convinced Republican legislators and GOP Governor Kim Reynolds to write two new state laws, one that requires districts to offer every student the opportunity to attend school full-time during a pandemic, and another prohibits schools from requiring students and staff to wear face masks. Republicans are convinced those issues helped them win both Ankeny State House seats in 2020, and the issue could still be a motivating factor in this special election. Of course, now parents who are upset at the aforementioned new state laws are beginning to speak out. So the question is whether the issue may now be motivating voters on the other side as well. Some of the campaign ads airing in the district have been interesting as well. The Republican candidate is Michael Buzlett, a Davenport native who served as a high-level staffer for both recent GOP governors Reynolds and Terry Branstad, and who most recently served as director of the State Department of Management. Given that resume, it's perhaps a bit funny that Buzlett's biographical campaign ad contains a swipe at so-called government bureaucracies. But even more intriguing is one campaign ad in the race which supports Phillips by tying Buzlett to Reynolds. That's intriguing because it appears Democrats are apparently attempting to take a page from National Republicans' playbook by making the race not so much about the opponent, but a familiar and more politically polarizing figure. In so many recent U.S. House elections, you would swear every Republican is running not against his or her actual opponent, but really against Nancy Pelosi. Democrats are trying a similar track in Iowa House 37 race by running an ad that features Reynolds, not Buzlett. A politically shifting district, local issues at play, and an intriguing advertising strategy. It all adds up to a special state house election worth watching. Now we're on to the obituaries. First, Mary Abigail Abby Binning, age 70, of Noola, passed away September 4, 2021, at CHI Mercy Hospital. Abby was born June 27, 1951 in Council Bluff to the late Marvin and Mary Margaret Bullard Sanson. She graduated from Nolo Tri-Center High School in 1969, Abby worked for many years at Eddie's and Menards. She was a member of St. Patrick Catholic Church and Nuella Lions Club, and a founding member of a Tri-Center Dollars for Scholars. In addition to her parents, Abby was preceded in death by her son, Eric Binning, and her sister, Joanne Scurry. Abby is survived by her sons, Marvin, Annie, Benning of Charles City, Iowa, Travis, Jamie Benning of Ankeny, Iowa, Dustin Benning of Ballard, Nebraska, 9 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren, sisters, Betty Ruckman of Harlan, Iowa, Colleen Lugin of The Colony, Texas, brother-in-law Richard Shorey of Panama, Iowa, many nieces and nephews. Visitation with the family Thursday, 5 to 7 p.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church, Nuella. Mass of Christian burial Friday, 10:30 a.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church, Nuella. Interment St. Patrick's Cemetery with a lunch following at the Parsh Hall. Memorials are suggested to Tri-Center Dollars for Scholars or St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Next, we have Grant Thomas Carl Forstall, age 23. Passed away September 5, 2021. He was born March 20, 1998, to Randall and Michelle Forstall in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Grant graduated from Lewis Central High School with the class of 2016 and worked as a concrete finisher with his father. He was preceded in death by his grandparents, Hazel Ivy, George Ivy, Darth Forstall, and Calvin Forstall. Grant is survived by his parents, Randall and Michelle Forstall, sister Cicero Forstall, nephews Connor Forstall and Abel McSorley, niece Grace McSorley, aunts, uncles, cousins, and many friends. Visitation is at the Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home from 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, September 8, 2021. Memorial service is at the funeral home at 1 p.m. on Thursday. Interment is in the Minnesonia Cemetery in lieu of flowers. Memorials are suggested to the Humane Society in Grant's honor. Carol Louise Georgian, aged 86, passed away peacefully on Sunday, September 5th, 2021, at homestead of Chris View in Washita, Kansas. She was born October 13, 1934, in Council Bluffs, Iowa. She married James Bernard Georgian of Dallas, South Dakota, on June 9, 1956. They had 4 children. She is preceded in death by her parents, husband James Georgian, daughter Tina Stanfield, son Jimmy Georgian. Carol was a homemaker who always had fresh baked bread or warm cookies from the oven when the children arrived from school. She attended all school events and holidays were very important times for the family to gather together. Christmas was always the favorite time of the year, from decorating the tree, attending midnight mass, and preparing the biggest family dinner of the year. In addition to her 2 daughters, Debbie McLean and Roxanne Smith, Carol is survived by 9 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. We invite friends and family to celebrate Carol's life on Friday, September 10th at Coulter O'Neill Mirror, Wood Ring, Bylis Park Chapel at 2 p.m. Following the memorial service, there will be a private graveside service for family members only. Joe Ann Benedict Hunt, age 68 years old, born September 11th, 1952, passed away September 6, 2021. Joe is preceded in death by parents Glenn and Lorraine Collins, first husband Ivan Benedict, brother Gary Collins. She is survived by husband Arles Hunt, son Shane Benedict, Lee Benedict, grandchildren Skylar Christianen, Alex Benedict, Jasmine Benedict, Ellen Elise Benedict, Brianna Benedict, great-grandchildren Emmy Christensen, sister Glenda Vanderpool, nieces, nephews, other loving family and friends. Service is Thursday, 2 p.m. at the Coulter O'Neill Miller Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Interment Hazel Dill Cemetery. Visitations Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Bayless Park Church, in lieu of flower memorials to your favorite charity. Rosalila Lee Bummy Longnecker, age 82 years old. Rosalie was born February 11, 1938 in Dow City, Iowa, to late Colin and Laura Miller, and passed away September 3, 2021 in Council's Bluff, Iowa. Rosalie graduated from Denson High School in 1957. She married Harvey Longnecker August 13, 1960. She was a secretary for the Potomac Mutual Insurance Company for many years. Rosalie was an avid blower, loved all sports, country music, and most of all, her family. Rosalie is preceded in death by her son, Craig Longnecker. She is survived by her husband of 61 years old, Harvey Longnecker, also survived by son, Keith Longnecker, four granddaughters, numerous great-grandchildren, other loving family and friends. A celebration of life gathering with sharing of memories will be held Thursday from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Coulter O'Neill Miller Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Casual attire. Private family graveside. Memorials to be directed by the family. Barbara Cookie Plum Beck, 73, of Parsa, Iowa, died on Sunday, September 5th, 2021. Visitation will be held Wednesday, September 8th, 2021, from 4 to 7 p.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Portsmouth, Iowa. Wake service at 7 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be Thursday, September 9th, 2021, at 11 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Portsmouth, Iowa. Interment at St. Mary's Cemetery in Portsmouth, Iowa. She is survived by her husband, Bill Palmbeck, of Persia, Iowa, children Tanya Palmbeck of Nuella, Iowa, Stacy Thomas of Nuella, Iowa, grandchildren Austin, Noah, Ryan, Abby, Jake, Maggie, Evan, great-grandchildren Peyton, Brecken, Little Bed, siblings Wanda Larson of Carver, Minnesota, Kathy Stevens of Persia, Iowa, Denise Wilson of Ankeny, Iowa, Mary Olson of Rosemount, Minnesota. Sydney Rodenberg, age 68, passed away peacefully at home in Omaha, Nebraska, September 5, 2021. She was born on July 22, 1953, to Bernie and Jacqueline Gibbings in Council Bluffs, Iowa. She was preceded in death by her father, Bernie Gibbons, and brother, Rick Gibbons. Sydney is survived by her husband, Rick Rodenberg, mother Jacqueline Gibbings, children Jessica Irwin and Christopher Rodenberg, and Ryan Rodenberg, sister Sheila Gibbons, mother-in-law Betty Jean Rodenberg, grandchildren Henry Rodenberg, Jackson Rodenberg, Ella Rodenberg, a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. at Hoy Kilinowski Funeral Home on Thursday, September 9th, 2021. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. at Hoy Kanoski Funeral Home on Friday, September 10, 2021. The family will direct memorials. Dallas James Sanders was born on June 15, 1945, to Merle and Herman Sanders at Janine Edomasi Son Hospital in Council Bluff, Iowa. Dallas graduated from Ovaha High School in May of 1962. On October 3, 1964, he entered his into marriage with Jolene Fone, and they had two daughters, Jill and Jody. Dallas loved watching his grandsons play baseball, classic cars, Budweiser, and was a big fan of the LA Dodgers. He passed away in the early hours of September 5, 2021, preceded in death by parents, siblings, Valerie and Tim, son-in-law, Jay, brother-in-law, Eldon, nephews, David and Derek. He is survived by daughters Jill Shiver of Persia, Iowa, and Jody Dolan of Minden, Iowa, sister Julie Gabriel, grandchildren Alex Shiver of Creston, Iowa, Eric Shiver of Harlan, Iowa, Riley Dolan of Council Bluffs, Iowa, Alex Wagner of Omaha, Nebraska, Nick Wagner of Omaha, Nebraska, Addie Wagner of Gretna, Nebraska, great-grandson Archie James Shover, nieces, nephews, family, and friends. No services will be held per Dallas request. Memorials may be directed to Midland Humane Society in Council's Bluff, Iowa. Leroy Sporjan, age 80, passed away September 4, 2021. He was born February 5, 1941, to the late John Stanford and Dorothy Louise Sporjan in Kansas City, Kansas. Leroy partly served in the United States Air Force and retired from Iowa Interstate Railroad. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by brother John Dale Sporjan. Leroy is survived by his wife, Helen Lewis, children Kenny Sporjan, Kylie Sporjan, Brian Sporjan, and Sydney Bulvase. Siblings Martia Louise McMillan and Caroline May Hedrick, daughter-in-law Carol Sporjan, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Visitation will be held from 2 to 3 p.m. at Hoy Konosky Funeral Home on Saturday, September 11, 2021. Funeral service will be held at 3 p.m. at Hoy Konosky Funeral Home on Saturday, September 11, 2021. The family will be direct memorial. His wife, Helen, respectfully requests those attending to wear a mask. Alida Mabel Snyker, September 1932, September 5th, 2021. Alida was a sixth child born to John and Angeline Martins on September 29th, 1932, in a farmhouse in Model, Iowa. In 1935, they moved to Star, Idaho, where she first learned about the love of Jesus at the Friends Church. After her father died in 1944, her family moved back to Iowa, setting down roots in Missouri Valley. In 1945, her faith continued to grow and she was baptized at the Church of Christ in Missouri Valley on July 8, 1945. She was united in marriage to Duane B. Satcher on November 30, 1951, and 3 years later they moved to Council's Bluff, Iowa. In March 1959, she became a member of the First Christian Church in Council Bluffs and enjoyed learning, growing, and serving faithfully. Throughout her 62 years there, Alida's strong work ethic, attention to detail, and ability to adapt led her to work her way up, from telephone operator to supervisor, and eventually to manager, as she saw the transition of Northwestern Bell to U.S. to AT&T. She remained in management until she retired in 1986 after 36 years with the telephone company. During her time there, she made many lifelong friends and invested in many lives while working full-time and raising five children. Alida also served as a Boy Scout leader and a Sunday school teacher. She was an active member of the Telephone Pioneers of America, Eastern Star, Beta Sigma Phi Sorority, Red Hat Lady Society, Lunch Bunch, and thoroughly enjoyed being active in the Joy Sunday School class, many Bible studies, and women's circle at church. She was also an avid reader and a collector of Holly Hobo memorabilia and porcelain dolls. Alida loved her family deeply as a wife, mom, grandma, great-grandma, sister, and aunt. She loved keeping herself busy in the kitchen and will be fondly remembered by her family for her amazing sense of humor and overabundance of homemade desserts, thin pancakes, chicken and noodles, and round steak. Her love for country and gospel music ran deep. She cherished every chance she got to rock her kids, grandkids, and sing When the Roll is Called Up Yonder. And of course, our family favorite, You Are My Sunshine. She had a way of making each of her grandkids believe they were her favorite. She preceded in death by her parents' husband, Duane, in 2001, infant son, Duane Benjamin Jr. in 1952, son Trevor in 1986, and son Mitchell in 2017. One sister, five brothers. She is survived by daughter Shawn Antherton, Council Bluffs, Iowa, sons Greg Satcher, Eckern, Northeast, and Brent. Ector, Nebraska, and Brent Satcher, Council Bluffs, Iowa. Grandchildren, Farrell Mahoney, Midbury, Indiana, Matthew Othern Jr., Nicholas Othern, Kala Othern, all of Council Bluff, Iowa, Chad Othern, Hersford, Arizona, Shanna Schatzler,
Cole Schatzler, Connor Schatzler, all of Omaha, Nebraska. Winnie Fangan, Bennington, Nebraska, Logan Schatcher, Council Bluffs, Iowa, Haley Satcher, Omaha, Nebraska, 17 great-grandchildren, sister Bessie Ryan, Sacramento, California, sister-in-law Pauline Mickey, Missouri Valley, Iowa, many nieces, nephews, and family friends. Visitations with the family, Thursday, 9 a.m. to 9:30 a.m., followed by funeral service at 9:30 a.m., all at the funeral home. Interment at 3 p.m. at Fraser Cemetery. Funeral will be live streamed at www.cutleroneill.com. Just click on Alita's obituary page and tribute wall. Memories to Camp of the God Shepherd, Deaf Missions, or HETRA, Heartland Inquin Therapeutic Writing Academy. Now on to sports. Our first article, half of U.S. offers legal sports betting as NFL season begins. More than half of the United States now offers legal sports betting, just 3 years after it was allowed by the U.S. Supreme Court. When the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and Dallas Cowboys kick off the NFL season Thursday night, gamblers in 26 states plus the District of Columbia are expected to be able to wager on it legally, according to the American Gaming Association, with as many as five additional states offering such bets before the season ends in February with the Super Bowl. That's up from 18 states with legal sport betting at the start of last year's football season. And some of the biggest markets in the U.S., including California and Florida, are moving towards legalization, with New York planning to adopt mobile sports betting at some point. The explosive growth of the industry comes as more and more companies join the fray, making it more challenging to gain and hold on to market share and profits. And it is making things worse for some people with gambling problems as the industry is coming up with new ways to bet on sports, including live micro-betting on the outcomes of things like this next position in the football game. There's no question this will be a huge year and it will be a record, said Eric Hinson, co-president of Caesars Digital, whose parent company brought the William Hill brand this year and renamed it Caesars Sports Bank. Jerry Arnold, the supervisor of the FanDuel Sportsbook at the Meadowlands Racetrack in East Rutherford, New Jersey, just outside New York City, said one trend is clear. Quote, a lot of people having a lot of money. He said, quote, they're getting unemployment or stimulus checks and they want to double or triple their money, they say. That all the time. I just got a check and I'm going to make double. FanDuel is the official odds provider for the Associated Press. More than 45 million Americans say they plan to bet on the NFL season this year. According to the American Gaming Association, the casinos industry national trade group, that's an increase of 36% from last year. Shane Williams, who is from New London, Connecticut, but now lives in New Jersey, was in Meadowlands recently to bet $1,000 on the New England Patriots to win the Super Bowl. He won a Super Sports bet 3 years ago and has been coming back ever since. Quote, I came here and won 1,000, so I'm going to keep flipping those tickets till I get a million, unquote, he said. Quote, that's my goal with their money, confidence. I came here to win, unquote. Mobile betting accounts for more than 80% of the sport betting revenue, much of it occurring live as games are underway. The NFL, which along with other professional leagues once structurally fought against the legalization of sport betting, now allows even sports betting companies to advertise during games, and teams in various sports have inked deals with companies to become official sports betting partners, including deals announced Wednesday involving the Baltimore Ravens and the New York Jets. Media companies continue to tie the knot with gambling firms, seeking synergies among gamblers who want to bet but also read and watch as much as they can about sports. Sports Illustrated has launched a sports book, and the Wall Street Journal reports that ESPN is considering a $3 billion deal to license its brand to one or more sports books. Even sports merchandise retailers Fanatics plan to launch a sports betting app. That's the ever-increasing competition is making it more difficult to win or hold on to a piece of the pie for sports betting companies. Market share will be harder and harder to retain over time as more entries come in, said Matt Prevost, chief revenue officer for BetMGM, but more states have come online in the last 12 months and are now new markets for us. Competition is fierce, added Johnny Avillo, head of sportsbooks for DraftKings. There's a lot of players in the game now, said David Schreshner, a gambling historian with UNLV. Quote, the cost of entry is going up as it becomes harder to displace established entities which have first mover advantage as well as the advantage of strategic partnerships. But if the product is good, bettors will respond to it. Jay Corningay, vice president of Westgate Superbook in Las Vegas, said the coronavirus pandemic still figures prominently in the sports betting equation this year, particularly as high contagion Delta variant surges. Quote, a lot of people still don't want to travel and be in crowds, and sports betting from their couch is very attractive to them, he said. You can spend $10 and be entertained for 3 hours. There are those who bet much more than that. Earlier this year, a study by the National Council of Problem Gambling found an increase in problematic gambling, particularly among young online sport bettors. Quote, this is a spike problem related to gambling reflects both the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic and the effects of the massive increase in sports betting and online gambling availability in more than half the country. Accessibility through mobile devices and widespread advertising, unquote, said Keith White, the group's president. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Buffs Daily Nonpareil for September 8th, 2021. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Irish volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Irish program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Brian Orellana from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, the Food and Drug Administration has announced two drug recalls this week. Sandoz is pulling all of its prescription ranitidine capsules because testing detected a suspected carcinogen called NDMA. Health authorities in Canada, much of Europe, and Taiwan have already issued recalls for Zantac and generic ranitidine. The FDA has not yet asked other U.S. distributors to pull their ranitidine products. Ranitidine is an H2 antagonist used to treat ulcers and acid reflux. In addition, Torrent Pharmaceuticals is recalling multiple lots of the blood pressure drug Losartan. This action is related to detection of the impurity NMBA. This nitrosamine compound is also a probable human carcinogen. Torrent has now recalled more than 300 lots of blood pressure medicines during the past year.
Aspirin has been getting mixed reviews lately. Earlier this year, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology said that low-dose aspirin should only be used by older people at high risk of strokes or heart attacks. Others, they said, would be more likely to be harmed. Now, though, researchers from Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center report that patients with head and neck cancer have a better chance of survival if they take low-dose aspirin while undergoing treatment. An additional 8% of patients taking the 81 milligram daily dose were still alive 5 years after treatment compared to those not taking aspirin. A different study at Roswell Park compared aspirin versus no aspirin among 164 patients being treated for early-stage non-small cell lung cancer. The patients got precision radiation therapy. 2 years after treatment, 57% of those taking low-dose aspirin were still alive compared to 48% of those who did not take the drug. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has also recommended that obstetricians consider recommending low-dose aspirin to patients at risk of preeclampsia. This complication of pregnancy can be extremely serious for both mother and baby. Women taking low-dose aspirin are 24% less likely to develop preeclampsia.
Scientists suggest that the Puerto Rican culinary tradition of incorporating sofrito into many dishes might help explain a lower rate of breast cancer there. This condiment is made with onions, garlic, peppers, cilantro, and a related herb, rucao. Epidemiologists found that Puerto Rican women who ate lots of garlic and onions, including sofrito, were 67% less likely to get breast cancer than those who never ate sofrito. The total intake of onions and garlic was important, not only the use of sofrito. The researchers point out that onions and garlic are rich in flavanols and sulfur-containing compounds that have anti-cancer activity.
Despite lots of information about how to eat healthily, Americans are still getting too much of their energy from low-quality carbohydrates. Nutrition scientists drew this conclusion from analyzing nutrition health and examination survey data from 1999 to 2016. Although the American diet got a little better over that time frame, the change was modest. Only 9% of calories in a typical American diet come from whole fruits and whole grains. About 42% comes from highly refined grains, added sugar, and starchy vegetables such as potatoes. The estimated healthy eating index went from 55.7 to 57.7. Although this change is statistically significant, it leaves plenty of room for improvement.
Americans are often exhorted to walk on the sunny side or look for the silver lining. Can such a cheery attitude influence your health? A recent meta-analysis in JAMA Network Open suggests that optimistic individuals are less likely to suffer heart attacks, strokes, angina, and death from cardiovascular causes. The analysis included 15 studies with a total of more than 200,000 participants. A pessimistic attitude increased people's risk of cardiac problems. The author suggests that health professionals might want to come up with interventions to reduce pessimism and promote optimism, especially in cardiac rehab programs. They express the hope that their study might stimulate research into the heart benefits of a sense of purpose or gratitude. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.